This is all stuff I talk about, like rewilding and ecology, the unnameable.
You have a lot of things that you talk about. Are these all things like you could get invited places, and these would be the choices? This is the menu.
Some of these I haven't written yet.
I'd like non-human enrichment rewilding from the urban out.
Yeah,
please.
I can help you with that.
The other thing that occurred to me was for the Super Seizure show, the issue of ethics and torture could be interesting to mention for a moment, because we're going to talk about Super Seizure and queen replacement and the interruption of the utopian, you know, model of the hive is both the violence between queens when they're naturally being replaced because they have to produce many more than the one that they need and can survive with. So there's a battle to the death. Mm-hmm. But also, most commercial beekeepers remove the queen from the hive every year and kill her and put a new one in there. So we could talk a little bit about
coup d'etat.
You could start by talking about what this show is in relation to this concept or category that you've created.
Okay, well, let's see. I know that the show is delving into life politics from multifaceted angles and is sort of looking at bees as metaphors and as real. And that's one of the places where, when I talk about vivo arts, I'm talking about art that's made with life. Now, you can make art for non-humans, and that's making art with life because it's art for a non-human. Now, humans are alive too, and that's a funny thing about us. But you can also make art with life two different ways. One is in collaboration with other humans or other non-humans or any kind of life form. Choose anything from the five phyla. Or you can make art with them, which is as a material without collaboration. Like smushing slugs. And that's a little different kind of withness. It's sort of less with it withness. So I would sort of say I sort of looked at the life world and tried to look at how we in our culture spontaneously break down the life world into more manageable chunks, right? And we tend to chunk it into, like, there's us, the living humans, and then there's all the other living beings, and they're like separate from us, and I call them the non-humans. But I think a lot of humans are non-human too, so it gets confusing. Then there's ecology, which is like the outside world. But a lot of people talk about ecology as if there's nothing in it except for trees, right? It's the green area. And I think that ecology is more than just trees. I think it's also all of the life world, including like right where you're sitting right now. Then there's food. And food is not, I mean, food is obviously grown in the outside world, but not, you know, usually it's considered to be coming from a farm. Food comes from a farm, not from the wild and not from human bodies. And if it does come from non-humans, they're very seldom wild. It happens. People go hunting, but then it's like, that's where the categories break down. And then there's this strange, strange thing. What's it called? Let me remember. It's a biotechnology. It's a totally different place. Now, we know that some of our food comes from the lab, and some of our human bodies get influenced by biotechnology, and ecology and biotechnology have their crossovers. But generally speaking, the non-humans that are in the lab are not animals, they're experimental objects. They're like material to not collaborate with, but to make science with in the not with it way. And so we sort of try to break things down into ecology and those others that aren't us and us and the food and that strange thing that we call biotechnology. And I'm trying to say or show or exhibit or play with the idea of mixing them all back up together and seeing what happens. And I think there's something going on in your show that's kind of like that, where you're trying to access consciousness of non-humans while talking about social issues, about biotechnology and food and the interactions between the two of them. And you've got your body in there. It's on the radio, but it's your body.
So super seizure happens in three ways. It's the process by which so-called queens are replaced. So there's a super seizure that happens with a swarm, which is when the hive it's the way that the hive reproduces itself when it gets very crowded and it's been successful at producing a lot more bees and there isn't space for them. It happens often when foraging stops and all the foragers are in the hive, so there are crowded conditions. And up to 20 queen cells are created, and then the old queen will leave with many of the bees of the hive, with the youngest of the bees, and go off to find a new home, and so the hive divides. And then once the old queen leaves before the first new queen has hatched, so these are all daughter queens, and they hatch at different times, and then there's this violent period where they're supposedly fighting to the death to determine who will be the new queen. Beekeepers who are doing this for profit, you know, go to great lengths to avoid a swarm. Natural super seizure will happen also when there's an emergency, when the queen doesn't come back from her mating flight, or if she dies, or if she's not laying adequately, she'll be replaced by the workers. And in that case, she won't leave on her own. She'll be either kicked out or killed by the new queens as they come. And then the last example of super seizure is the most common one in commercial beekeeping, where the beekeepers, to make sure that they get the most reproduction, they get the greatest number of eggs produced each year, they put a new queen into every hive each year, and so at the end of that year, they pull the queen out and kill her.
How?
And put a new...
How they kill the queen?
I read one book where it was described that her head was removed. Like, it was a very quick, neck-breaking, head-smashing kind of event.
That's actually, because I'm sort of interested in what's termed, I guess, in the labs as humane sacrifice. Because I think that's sort of an oxymoron, but we have official laws on how to sacrifice animals in the laboratory that are not unlike laws of how to perform capital punishment. In a way, there's a certain humanity that's preserved by something called a speedy death or a painless death. And I have a question as to, A, whether or not that's more humane. Which is more humane, speedy death or painless death, or a death with 5 minutes of reflection? I mean, I'd rather have some pain and be able to reflect at least for 5 minutes. Like, wow, I really fucked up over here, and that was pretty good. And sun's still coming up, and at least be able to say goodbye to the world before I go. So a more humane sacrifice of myself would be to have 5 minutes of reflection, even with pain. But in the case of insects in the laboratory, they're not considered animals. Insects don't have vertebrae, and apparently their frontal lobes aren't developed enough to have self-reflection, according to people that like to decide these sort of things. And so insects aren't given the same rights of humane sacrifice, and at least the review of their extinguishment doesn't have to go through a care and use committee. But actually, they can be killed at will.
As opposed to dogs or bunnies or cats, is there a whole hierarchy of...
There is. I mean, it's a bilaterally symmetrical organisms. And then if they have two eyes. Insects are both of those, but then there's the spine, the type of brain, whether or not they can test for things like recognition in a mirror. Really sort of strange deliberations, and certainly how cute they are. In other words, rats and mice get less rights than, say, a dog or a cat. There's research done on dogs and cats, but there's more research done on those whom we consider to be pests, right? And those animals in our mythos are less cute, even though a rat can be very cute. Mice, I don't know, but rats, yeah.
Do you know why the word sacrifice is used? It just strikes me as very odd. It's like a religious term.
I think it is a replacement of religion. I think scientific research, to a great degree, like an awful lot of it, is geared towards uncovering the unknown, like de-veiling the world. And I don't know if it works a lot of the time. A lot of the time, animal research is done unnecessarily, but it's possible that it is a real sacrificial rite. In other words, like, when it's done unnecessarily, it's for the production of knowledge, which is our religion these days. Like, how much knowledge can we produce? As much as we can produce. Does anyone know what a worm is or what a piece of fruit is? No, we don't know. But we can keep trying, and if we have to kill like 6 million rats to do it, there's certainly some sort of altar to the production of knowledge where these rats' bodies are being placed in front of. And maybe it's not that different. Maybe that's what drives the mechanization of the world, is this spiritual decapitation. But interestingly, you said that the head was destroyed, or the queen's neck was severed, like it was decapitated. And that's one of a few different methods, none of which are humane in my viewpoint, but that is practice. So there are things like lethal injection or gas chambers or decapitation or just being put on ice and things like this. But I actually thought about decapitation, and it functions along the lines of this sort of myth of the mind-body dichotomy, that if your head is cut off, then you don't feel the pain of your body. And then your body can writhe in pain, but it's humane because your head is detached from it. And nobody sort of really stopped to think, it might hurt a lot from the neck up. Because people assume that, you know, your mind can't feel pain without its body. And I'm like, I don't know. I don't want to be decapitated. I think it would hurt a lot from where I got my neck cut off to up. And I'd be like, ow, ow, ow. But no one would hear it because I wouldn't have lungs to scream. So I thought maybe we should do some decapitation experiments where we made air go through the throat of rats after they're decapitated so we could hear whether or not they're screaming. And that would prove whether or not the mind-body dichotomy was true.
I was wondering if you have seen any evidence or heard of any evidence or have observed anything related to animals or insects experimenting upon humans.
I think that most of our products and drugs are byproducts of non-humans that have co-evolved with us and got us to cultivate them. For instance, when a person goes to weed and take the weeds out from around the squash plant that's growing, that is supposedly for human material needs, like I need squash, but actually it's worshiping the squash plant to the detriment of other plants, that you have actually decided to do this sort of eugenic experiment where you're going to only grow the true squash and not the dandelion. And in to a great degree, I think, of the cultures that are based on coca or opiates or cannabis or even potatoes, which is, you know, everything that you imbibe is a psychoactive drug. I know, because when I eat a lot of mashed potatoes, I get into this altered state like, oh, kind of a Simpsons effect. But like the potatoes and the poppies and the coca plants have driven addicted humans to complete their life cycle over and over. Certainly beekeeping would count as this. Like, in other words, even though it's supposedly for honey, it's also perpetuating the bees above mosquitoes. Like, there are very few mosquito hives that are kept, right? Even though it'd be a great place to get free blood samples for a blood bank.
So are you at all suggesting that bees are actually manufacturing honey as this drug that addicts us in order to establish some kind of hierarchy for themselves over flies?
Not just over flies, but yes, like you said, over humans. Like, in other words, that we would be catering to them like maids. And you can see that even honey is a term of endearment. You know, like you say, hey, honey. And it's sort of like our language has been co-opted by, what is it, bee? Is it regurgitation? It's like we refer to each other as bee vomit as a term of endearment. So surely we have some non-human takeover of our behavioral tropes. When it comes to pets, everybody knows that they can try to talk to their pet and have like a psychic relationship, but generally what they get from their pet is like, I'm not going to do it your way, you're going to do it my way. And so I think, you know, a lot of our relations are based more than we would think on our submission to the ecosphere. We've managed to push it away with various different categorizations, right? So like, if we call it a farm, it's under our jurisdiction and we have dominion over the farm, except for you have to wake up every morning and cater to everybody's needs, plant, animal, you know, insect. In biotechnology, you know, there's supposedly this objective top-down thing, but actually it's a kind of ancestor worship. Like, people are going in and I asked the scientist, I watched him sort of like spreading plates with bacteria, and certainly like E. coli is a totem organism in like a fermentation lab where everyone is worshiping E. coli and keeping certain strains of E. coli alive and replating them and storing them in cryogenic containers. And then I said to him, I think this is ancestor worship. Like, we come from E. coli. We come from single-celled organisms. And he said, I think it's ancestor rape. And I was like, this is from scientist's lips. I was like, oh my goodness, did you just say that? That's out of hand, like, honest. Because we're not just preserving these lines, but we're doing everything we can to, like, break them apart and tear them open and look inside. But in some ways, I don't differentiate that much. We're not just raping our ancestors, but we're raping our own integrity in the name of truth. And I don't think that's even a strange thing that happens in bars. That happens in conversation, right? I mean, that's like analysis. It's a horror.
I was thinking about that idea of the bees experimenting on us or controlling us in relation to the mosquito or something, and it seems like it's not really working too well.
Their control of us, you mean?
I mean, it really depends on what their aim is. But
it's hard to imagine what their goal is. We would like to probably imagine that they want this beautiful earth with all these flowers to pollinate. That's what we would envision for them. But maybe they want us to destroy the earth.
If the experimentation is successful, is going their way, that seems more...
Oh, with this colony collapse and this idea that they're going to another place, they have a better place to go to, they've discovered their nirvana, then perhaps they just want us to all self-destruct here.
that just reminded me that I wanted to ask Adam Zaretsky if he has colony collapse disorder, if you're disordered with colony collapse.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm pretty flagrantly borderline sometimes, but I was studying for a while Lynn Margulis' theories on endosymbiosis, which is that there are organisms that live inside of organisms but aren't parasites, but that work with them. Sometimes they just eat at the same table, like commensalism, but sometimes they're symbiotic and they interact in a relational way that's positive for both sides. But I got a little paranoid, maybe like Ryder is talking about, that I think that our neurons are made of ancient spirochetes. So like the nerves that make up our brain and our spine, you can sort of see when we were a single-celled animal, something like a sperm tail grabbed onto our butts and crawled up and made a hole there and crisscrossed and made this nervous system that leads up to our brain, where they formed a hive, and the hive has eyes, and that's our brain. And it's peeking out of what was just a sort of like a dumb somatic, easygoing, laid-back bubble person. And now there's this drive to eat, more than eat, but to cognate and to look and to build heavy machinery and to like bulldoze stuff. And I gather that those spirochetes hate oxygen, can only live in our butts, in our spinal fluids, in our brains. They can't live outside. The brain wants to go back outside, but there's all this oxygen here made by like, you know, phytoplankton and chlorophyll and the plants. They really pissed off a lot of bacteria. They really set them back. They had to crawl under stones. They had to live in our shit and murky swamps down in the depths because they can't come outside, because actually the atmosphere is not good for them. So the destruction of the earth is not the destruction of life. The destruction of the ecosphere as we know it, if we bulldoze everything, unless the entire atmosphere is gone, and even if it is, there are bacteria living 12 miles down in the rocks that will start producing ammonia again. And they'll be like, this is much more breathable. I don't think we can kill the life force of the planet, much less the universe. I think it's really strong. But we can kill ourselves and everyone we know. And we can set ourselves on vibrate and vibrate ourselves out. But like, I don't know. I don't know if it's not just a plan of non-humans to get us to change the atmosphere for them through like fossil fuel overuse, which is actually the worship of dinosaurs, right? Like we're taking dinosaur-ish and dinosaur bones and pulling it out of the earth and burning it. And we're maybe built to set ourselves back in time before humans, into a time before plants even, when bacteria roamed the earth and had a great time without oxygen. Maybe we were built by them to do this sort of, instead of leaving to another planet, maybe Utopia is like an all ammonia atmosphere here for bacteria to be like out and free and partying, and our brains will like leave our bodies and go live outside without us. I want to talk to you guys about rewilding. I want to hear what you think. There's that guy, Dave Foreman, from Earth First, and after 9/11, I think someone from George Bush's camp called up Dave Foreman and said, you have to say that you have disbanded Earth First. Now, Earth First still exists, but Dave Foreman is not a part of it officially anymore because he was threatened with being labeled a terrorist group because of putting the nails in trees and stopping logging and things like this, monkey wrenching.
Was he one of the pivotal members of Earth First?
Yeah, he helped start it. And so he disavowed his Earth First relationship. And then he started something called the Wildlands Project. I think it's TWP.org. And the idea is that we need large mammals, and we need predator large mammals like bear and wild cats and wolves in order to have a real ecosystem. The problem with large mammals is that they actually need large areas. And although we have these parks, sometimes the population of large mammals gets large enough that they need to migrate, and they have no place to migrate to. They're stuck in a park that's a jail. It has a border, and on the edge of the border is either a freeway, a mall, or a golf course. And every time they go to any of those three places, they get shot, right? For being on the golf course and doing something like what a wolf or a wildcat would do on a golf course. So his plan is to create eco-corridors between parks so that actually all parks are eventually networked and connected so that everything, every non-human from armadillo to, you know, fox to aardvark to lynx can migrate to different places to have more space. And actually, one of the political things he's doing, which relates to what you're talking about, is he's trying to get parks connected by corridors across borders. He eventually wants a corridor all around the world, but he's starting, one of his major projects is from Panama to the Yukon. And certainly on the U.S. and Mexican border, and certainly on the U.S. and Canadian border, there are some political problems with the idea of there being a pathway for non-humans to cross the border without national sovereignty being respected by these non-humans, you know. And at the same time, I think it's a beautiful project, and I'm kind of interested in these wildlife corridors being a sort of way of talking about internationalism. So I wonder what you guys think about that.
Well, it just makes me think about the so-called Africanized bees and thinking about movement of different animal creatures. And I think that if animals relocate themselves, then we won't be up against, there won't be so many complications. For instance, the killer bee probably never would have wanted to come here in the first place. It would have gone somewhere else if it needed to go somewhere. It would have gone somewhere to a climate that it could live in. So it seems lovely that the animals would be able to do that.
I'm a little bit confused about, because I think that there are a lot of human misconceptions about what's natural or is related to our nostalgia for a simpler, purer, more real kind of organization of living creatures that was based on their natural habitat, you know, that wasn't so choreographed by humans and human needs and greed or reckless destruction. So I'm curious about the basic, I like the vision, I like coming up with a way to start to pick away at or destroy pieces of national borders. I think that's the most exciting part about it. I don't totally understand the basis of his argument, why, just asking that kind of stupid question maybe about why is it important to have the predators? Why is it important to have the large mammals? Is he addressing specific problems that need to be fixed, or is it just assumed that having more and all of the animals that were once here, and does he distinguish between native and non-native? Like, what's the philosophical basis and what's being addressed exactly? It's not xenophobia and the problem of nation states. It's something else, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, he's talking actually about eco-balance. It's not something often thought of, but, I mean, things like deer overpopulation or raccoon overpopulation, a lot of these organisms are overpopulating because they don't have any natural predators except for humans. Humans have managed to kill everything that's larger than themselves that they can, especially anything that has any minor threat, right? So all mammals that seem like they might be associated with being larger than us or similar size or have larger teeth or seem to be competing in viciousness to us, we've managed to control, kill, isolate, and fairly well annihilate to the point where we're starting to try to protect them again as endangered species. But He's actually just talking about a natural ecosystem that involves other predators than us, and that this is a way towards a sound ecosystem. At the same time, yes, you're probably right. He's heroizing some of the non-humans that are pretty cool. You know, eagles and lynx and wolves are in all of our myths, and they may not exist as beings on the earth after a while. They'll just be myths.
I also think that there are examples in the past of humans trying to create balance. You know, maybe the parks that are islands and jails too, that experiments with that, or these mapped out plans that go awry. So it's hard to imagine. And it's interesting too. I mean, where I live and keep bees, the bears are coming back. So I'm affected by that. And in areas not that far from here, the population of coyotes have gotten so big that people can't have their precious cats and pets out, you know, after dark or on a rainy day.
Yeah. I mean, you're talking about stewardship and the impossibility of being stewards of the earth because we can't predict the future and because we have sometimes just the weirdest, heaviest hands. We even when they're carrying hands, they seem to be like crushing hands. Maybe we don't know how to be good mothers. You know, it's possible that we're overbearing even when we care. But the idea of giving back 2/3 of the earth to non-humans and isolating ourselves in cities might be a way of sort of admitting that if we think we're so damn queer, we should leave the rest of the world out of it. Like in the transgenic project, as far as I can see, it's sort of need to take over not just stewardship of the earth, which is suspect, but also evolution itself, the force of evolution. I'm sort of like, okay, we can do that. Like, but we're weird and we have a strange track record, and maybe we should like keep that contained because we're going to not just force evolve foreign species that never would have existed before, that shouldn't be released into the ecosphere, that will create imbalance, like 2/3 of our food right now, but also that we're going to start engineering ourselves, and we too will be in need of containment. So if we were nice enough or thoughtful enough or even some kind of sci-fi enough to give back 2/3 of the world to not be managed, but just to be a border for humans not to pass and post-humans and their transgenic friends to be kept inside of sort of like a giant laboratory for humans and transgenic others, transgenic humans, because we're going to be very strange in 100 or 200 years. I mean, I'm all for it. I'm sort of like, we should be plaid and queer and covered with like clitori and rolling around a lot, but maybe we shouldn't be outside.
We need to quarantine ourselves. That's the best idea I've heard in a while.
Do you think there should be special park jails for humans?
Yes. Why make all these corridors for these animals? Maybe we just have to put ourselves, we just have to make the corridor. We've already done it. The work is already there. We just have to quarantine ourselves, as you suggested, into the urban centers.
Well, if this plan were to go forward and it was successful in bringing back a lot of predators, including having a lot more bear and other creatures, then it might prove to be really appropriate that Africanized bees, or that the behaviors that come from bees that originated in Tanzania, would be here so that their defenses could be effectively used against other kinds of large predators besides humans. I don't know, what kind of habitat would you design for the quarantine? You really want to go be quarantined with other humans?
No, but it seems like the only thing left to do.
We can still go camping. We just put on like spacesuits and go out into the nature with like a spacesuit on so we wouldn't contaminate the world. And we could light a fire and have a little pup tent and enjoy the nature through our plastic screen. It's not unlike what we're doing right now anyhow. It's just a little bit more, you know, formal.
It's a great idea. I feel like in this moment, I can have some hope for the future quarantine plan.
It definitely feels like a break from that more better stewardship kind of model that was just previously mentioned.
Yeah,
if we just have find the right humans with the right plan, we can fix all of this.
I feel that Adam Zaretsky, that this idea of the human just being the bad mother, no matter how hard we try, is perhaps accurate. And the quarantine is the way to go. The stewardship is not, it's just, we're just lying to ourselves.
Oh, I mean, I'm interested because I heard on your radio show, I was listening in the shower, I turned up really loud because I was like enjoying it, and you were talking about different bodies for the future and different ways of reproduction. And I think one of the reasons to quarantine ourselves is that we're going to start engineering ourselves. And there are lots of ways we can go. And I'm sort of interested in the different aesthetics. I fear people that are into genetic enhancement. I don't want to live forever. Like, immortality is not for me. And I also think that perfect health is not really our long-term goal. I think our long-term goal, just like it's been for some time now, is actually high weirdness. We need to feel special. Maybe we have insecurity problems, but like high weirdness is to say that maybe we want antlers, right? Maybe we want eyes under our arms. Maybe we want to be striped like a zebra. And we can get these eyeball genes and express them ectopically under our arms, or antler body plan developmental sort of injectables in our skull, and they'll grow. Or we can actually be having children, probably in vats, you know, with various different leopard spots or zebra spots or extra limbs or any of these special, maybe even pornographic body plan reorganizations. But certainly there is the same sort of problem that we have with GMOs. We would be the GMOs. We'd be genetically modified. And actually, by crossing the species barriers and mixing ourselves, whether it's with deer or with squid or fungus or bees, that we would represent foreign species on the planet that were already capable of quite a lot of invasion. But this would be another unknown factor as far as eco-stability. And not everything about ecology is stable, but certainly when you're crossing the species barrier, the major difference is the speed of change. Because it's possible to cross the species barrier. If you have sex with a bee every day for your whole life, after 1 or 2 or 300 or 3,000 lifetimes, sooner or later, something might happen, right? So that's 3,000 lifetimes with the bee, making love as some sort of like experiment, maybe, you know, idolatry. And eventually those germ cells might find a way to mix. But just taking genes from bees and sticking them into our germline, into ovaries and sperm and embryos, we can do that today. Like, it might only take a couple of years to find out if we have a bee person that otherwise might take 300 lifetimes. So we have a speed of new kinds of species that aren't based on old-fashioned kinds of bestiality, but this new sort of like biotechnologized bestiality of having sex with non-humans and actually coming up with a viable procreation that it could be beautiful, but it's an ecological unknown, like the effect.
It's interesting thinking of ourselves as genetically modified I usually think of us already as genetically modified just because we consume so many genetically modified things into our bodies as food. And really, bees are pretty... Beehive bees, honey bees, except for the wild bees, they're pretty much genetically modified too. They're begun in the laboratory and sent out to the beekeepers. But really what I was thinking about was the parthenogenesis of the bees, where the queen is both the mother and the father.
The queens are the mother and the father of the drones.
Are they ever the mothers and the fathers of the workers?
No, the workers are the result of eggs that are fertilized by the sperm from the sperm sac.
They are the daughter of the drone. They're the daughter of the drone and the queen. Well, okay, so with this parthenogenesis and the queen being the mother and the father of the drone, I just started thinking about us as also being, that we're parthenogenic too in this way of kind of replicating ourselves through all of the things that we consume somehow. I don't quite have it all formulated, but I saw this correlation in my mind as you were talking.
I think about this sometimes. When I first went to work in the lab at MIT, I was really scared of genetically modified organisms. And I learned to be both less scared and more scared from actual experience with them, like hanging out with them. But I had an argument with a scientist. I said, when we eat genetically modified foods, can we receive transgenes from them into our body? And then I realized I should even ask, when we eat regular organic corn, do we become what we eat? Are we what we eat? Do we become kind of corn people? And he said, no, the stomach acid is so strong in your body that it takes all the proteins and breaks them down into amino acids, which then get reincorporated into replication for making more things like fingernails and hair and spit. And I said, well, that can't be true, because sometimes when I eat corn, I look at my dish and I see whole corn kernels in there. So they were obviously in contact with my gut.
Also, if you think of the queen bee, if you look at the queen bee, she's made into the queen just from this nutrition of this royal jelly that the workers create. So that's, she seems like such a kind of example of how you are kind of what you eat in a way.
Yeah, so they also grew some bacteria with mammalian cells in a dish, and the bacteria had transgenes in them, and they grew them together just for like a couple of weeks, and the transgenes had transferred to the mammalian cells as well. And so I think that there's a lot that we're starting to find out, A, that our genome is not sacrosanct, but that it actually is open, and that genes from other organisms and from other people actually get into us through all the holes in our bodies, and probably through words, like through the radio. It's possible that like genes are transferred through the radio.
Adam, just have to leave that one at that, because it's so good. How has this having these ideas and the kind of research that you do, an observation, affected your relationship to other living things, and including the living things that you put in your body for nutrition and other animal and living creatures in the world, you know, that you share space with?
I do feel like we're not anthropocentric for relating to other organisms. That's not anthropocentrism. It is if you're like, oh, cute, Mickey Mouse. You know, there's a point where it gets kitsch, like too many flowers on Hallmark cards can ruin your love life. But we all came from the same ancestral organism. Some single-celled, archaic, weird bacterium appeared on the planet somehow. Maybe it was from outer space. Maybe it was from clay. And then every living form on the planet is related. So you're not being anthropocentric by relating to a plant or a mushroom or a squid. You're actually being microbocentric, right? Like we're all from microbes, and so we are related. So you can second guess what a carrot is being like in the world. What's it like to be a carrot? A lot like what it's like to be a human. It's not that different. So it's not being anthropocentric by putting emotions onto a bee or a carrot or an algae. If you look at bacterium under a microscope, they show signs of anxiety sometimes. And it's not projection. They're actually anxious. Microbes can be anxious. And that's okay. And it's not projection alone. It's actually like the life force. One of the defining things about a life force is that it's capable of being anxious. And I've seen it in dogs. And I believe I can sometimes see it even in a growing mushroom. Feeling not so good about Swedish weather. Something like that.
So were you saying in an indirect way that you are considering, you're doing the thing that's misnamed as projection, that that's how your relation is affected by your research and your ideas, considering the perspective of a carrot, having a heightened, less boundaried kind of relationship with other living things?
Well, it's confusing to me because I like the idea of being related to all living beings on the planet and giving them beingness, just like humans have special beingness, that maybe all life forms are special for being alive and deserve to be thought of in the same way that we attempt to think of each other. But I look around at how we exhibit our humaneness, our humanity, and I'm not that impressed. And one of the things that I've had to come to terms with is that when you start looking beyond, say, genocide and war and torture and just general competitiveness, and you start looking at things like food and sex and even breathing, and you start seeing actually that there's so much violence that goes unacknowledged that when you brush your teeth, that's genocide. You know, you're killing millions of bacteria that have grown overnight. And the reason that you're killing them is so that you won't have smelly breath. It's not even, you know, I mean, it might be a little bit of tooth decay, but most of it is an aesthetic preference to kill 30 million bacteria every morning. Or more than there are humans on Earth. And that's like called crest, aim, or sometimes Toms of Maine, right? And this is the problem I have with eating, right? If I can relate to a carrot and I can also shred a carrot to make a carrot salad, maybe with some raisins and some honey, right? That's actually murder. Not just meat is murder, but also salad is murder. And so is like trying to get rid of foot fungus or having a tumor removed or the most simple thing, like breathing. Now, there are certain things that we can do to ameliorate. I think you guys are talking about some of them, like having organic burials would be nice. Even cremation is bad for the environment. It's a greenhouse gas problem. You don't get any carbon credits for cremation. It shouldn't be washed into sewers with lots of fresh water. Like, we should all be dishing in a bucket.
And I know that you can't say this on the radio.
No way. Okay, well, what about coprophilia?
I think that the FCC would probably not catch that one.
Well, let's just say this. Plants are coprophiliacs. That's why we use like manure. We give them manure, which is, you know, comes from cows or bats or horses.
Chickens.
And then plants are also carnivorous. They actually eat bone and blood and decomposing bodies. When I was an organic farmer, we added manure, blood meal, bone meal, and fish meal to the soil, along with vermiculite and some bluestone or greenstone. And like, this was amendments to give to the plants, because besides sunlight and air, they actually like to suck through their roots like vampires any and all living meat byproducts. So it's a strange thing, but they're kind of like really patient vampires. Plants just sit there and they say, I hope some crickets die today. And actually, like by random statistical happenstance, things do die near most plants. You know, if you look at an annual scattering of death, it's pretty evenly scattered around the earth. And plants just sit there. It's like fishing without a fishing pole. They just sit there and wait, and stuff does die and create topsoil. And worms chew it up for them, and they say thanks, and then they grow and make fruit. And some of them go on to, like, tell humans, take this fruit and plant it. Why don't you eat it? Why don't you swallow the seed? But we swallow the seed of the orange, and then we go and put it in the toilet. It's the wrong place. We have to put it back into a random scattering. So perhaps our excrement should be randomly scattered. If we have to use airplanes, you know, and just like collect all of our raw sewage without any treatment, and then send airplanes by remote control to randomly scatter this manure around the earth.
Are you volunteering for that job?
Well, I think I could drive 30 or 40 drones, not predator drones or bee drones, but actually robot-controlled sewage scattering drones. I'm volunteering to randomly scatter that incredibly rich resource around at least the county. I could start in the county, I think.
I heard that there is an unmanned plane being produced on this campus. I don't think it's for this purpose, but this might be a repurposing. If we do that thing of creating a review board to look at the ethics of various art displays and engineering research and projects that are funded by the university, it might be an interesting redirection of the unmanned plane.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it could be a way to give back to the county or the state and re-green in a way that's just sort of like sharing equally by scattering, you know, a smattering of our refuse in every direction. And that's appropriate technology.
Why not change the world?